I'm still Mark and Alcoholic. It is now time for a newcomer ask. That portion of our program where we set this box in the back of the room along with a stack of 3x5 cards and some pencils. And we ask people to write down questions that they have about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Put those questions in the slot, and we will draw one at random to be answered by our panel of experts and also using AA-approved literature. The one question we had in the box this week was selected randomly and given to one of our resident experts, which is in fact our speaker tonight, Jerry.
I don't have a card.
Who has a question?
The question.
Hi, I'm Jerry. I'm an alcoholic. I don't have the card, but I do have... Okay. A fairly good memory. Okay, why are you guys prejudiced against addicts? Why don't you want us to talk? And this is my opinion, because I don't know that I'm a resident expert, but I do have a few days sober. It is my belief that it's not a prejudice, it's a tradition issue, that Alcoholics Anonymous has a singleness of purpose, which means that our single purpose is to assist other alcoholics in achieving sobriety. And although we recognize that there are other addictions, because this is not a book based on addiction, our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous addresses alcoholism. And so I was taught early in recovery that when I'm in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I address my issues of alcoholism. When I'm in other 12-step meetings, which I qualify for many, then I can address those issues in those 12-step meetings. And so, this is also the way I look at it. I know a lot of addicts believe that they didn't have a problem with alcohol, but put yourself on a desert island where there is no drugs and all there is a bottle of booze. I guarantee you, you will become an alcoholic. So, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You're welcome here. Maybe you need to do some step work to identify how your addiction may have also had an issue associated with alcohol. Okay, that's all.
Thanks, Jerry. And now it is time for our featured speaker of the evening. This is brought to you by the Valley Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, the undefeated, undisputed king of speaker meetings. This event is brought to you for your sobriety pleasure. So now, let's get ready for recovery. Our speaker's been a sober member since 1988. She has been continuously in service as a GSO representative, treasurer, secretary, and sponsor. Her AA motto is, you can't heal what you can't feel. And now, with all the earnestness at your command, will you welcome, please, from Visalia, Jerry T.
I swear, I feel like I need to come out swinging. I'm Jerry. I'm an alcoholic. God, he got me all nervous. Well, let me get rid of this. Nerves, I'm getting warm. I've never been to this meeting. I just want to say I thought it was absolutely wonderful how people come up and get their chips and introduce themselves and everybody claps. You know, some of the things that we used to do when I first got sober was celebrate all the newcomers, and it's really neat to see that happening in this meeting because it doesn't always happen in meetings. It's always, you know, kind of a weak clap when somebody gets up to get a chip sometimes, and so I really love it that, you know, you're making recovery exciting. That's neat because when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I just want to say that I wasn't very happy. I was pretty miserable. I was very lonely. I was very sad. I felt like I didn't belong. And when I drank, all those things didn't matter anymore. And so when I got here, I really didn't know if I fit in here, and so for a long time I performed. I was the clown, I was the hoochie mama, I was, you know, I really love it that today in my recovery I can go without makeup and be okay with who I am, you know, like, because I used to have to pull out all the tight, blinky, whatever before I would go anywhere, and I didn't think that I was enough without all of that. And what I realized today is that I'm better without it, you know. As a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous, I also want you to know that when I first got sober, there was not a lot of women in AA that had some recovery time, that, you know, the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, as I look across the room today, I can see that, you know, there's a really good, even balance between men and women. And it wasn't that way when I first got sober. It was, you know, very difficult. You'd sit in a meeting, and this was, you know, like almost convention-sized meeting back then, because there was not the rooms were small, they were smoke-filled, and it was a warm place, it was a loving place. I did all of my stuff in bars and stuff like that, so I did all my stuff right out there in front of God and everybody. And I was a social butterfly, and so it was really wonderful to me, for me to come to a place where I could do all the same things but just not be sober, and people would allow me to make mistakes and love me anyway, and listen to my insanity, because there was a lot of that. And I remember sitting at my kitchen table with my friend Nancy, and we would get the big book and the 12x12 out, and we would start reading it and try to figure all of this stuff out. And neither one of us had sponsors at that time, and so we were just trying to figure out the literature. And so everywhere we went, we would look for more literature, you know, everything, not just AA, but whatever we could get our hands on, because I was a sponge. I wanted to know. I didn't want to miss out on any one piece of information that might keep me sober. And I also, when I chaired a meeting at that time, I thought that I had to share everything. And so I guess want to let the newcomers know that you don't have to do your fifth step when you chair a meeting. It's totally okay for you to leave some things out, you know. It says we share in a general way what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. And it doesn't say that you have to give up every single piece of information in an open room of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, that whole saying about you're as sick as your secrets, that doesn't apply to here. And so I don't share in a meeting anything that I haven't already done some work on, so that I'm not damaging myself. You know, I think if you haven't done some work on yourself in that area, then you probably shouldn't share it in an open meeting, because I've seen people share stuff they're not ready to share, and then we don't see them again. You know, we get into a lot of shame behind things that we did, and we want to purge it really fast. That was my experience. And so I thought that just because everybody was in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, that they were completely trustworthy. And by the laughter, I can tell that you understand. You know, some are sicker than others. And we're not all well. Just because we're here doesn't mean that we have all of the capacity that's necessary to be trusting, loving, and compassionate people. We can get there. There's work to be done to get there, but we come in here damaged folks, you know? And so that's why we have 12 steps and a big book to read. So I say give yourself a break. Welcome. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, because this is truly where you can start to heal the real issues that led to the drinking to begin with. You know, alcohol was nothing but a symptom to my disease. It's what took away all of the crazy thinking in my head. Like, I don't know about you guys, but on a good day, there's only two or three going on. My head never shuts up. It's in constant, full-on go mode. I'm having your conversation and my conversation a lot of the time. And I've had to get really creative in finding things that would direct my thinking into a more constructive way than a destructive way. And I'm not perfect at it. You know, I've now taken my obsessions into work. Work and food are now the big ones. And the onion skin gets peeled back, and I get to where I think I'm good, and I settle in, and I'm thinking, all right, this is good. I got me a hobby. Now I got to have everything that goes with that hobby. You know? It's like nothing is, there's no mediocrity anywhere. You know, there's no, when people say, well, take it in moderation, I'm like, what the hell is that? You know, I don't know what that is. And so I have a really hard time with sitting still. You know, that 1 minute meditation that we did. Oh, hell no. That had to be more than a minute. Seriously? I close my eyes. I'm like, yeah. And I'm thinking, it's got to be almost open tonight. Open my eyes, and everybody's still all, you know? Man, that's always been hard for me. So what it was like. I was a blackout drinker, a periodic, as the book calls it. I didn't drink every single day, so I didn't believe that I was an alcoholic. My dad was what I gauged as an alcoholic, and he was a functioning alcoholic. He had a good job and supported his family, our family, until he retired, and even then some. And that he would sit in his chair, swing around, get up, go get a beer, come back, until all the beer was gone, and or until he waddled off to bed. And I always was very, very resentful over the fact that when he was drinking, he would drink himself into intellectual stupid. And, you know, we'd have a conversation, and I felt like I would say one thing, and he would say one thing, and we were saying the same thing, but because I was using different words than he did, we were disagreeing. And it was maddening to me. And I resented how he was when he drank. And so I did things really passive-aggressive, and so I wouldn't drink with him. Because I believed that if I drank with him, I was giving him permission to drink, as if I was the demigod of all alcohol. And so I would get dressed up and go out, and I would drink at the bar. You know, it was my way of staying in denial about whether or not I was an alcoholic. You know, I constantly compared myself to everybody else that I believed was an alcoholic, and I found myself picking those of lesser sort so that I could believe that I was better than all the other alcoholics that I spent time with, you know. I was not too much of a passer-outer. I was a blackouter. So I would keep going, and everybody else would go, you know, pass out, and I would keep going, and, you know, so they were lops. And you know, I always found a way to be a better alcoholic than the guy next to me. I drank competitively. I liked to drink tequila. And so I would belly up to the bar, and I would start buying people drinks. And the whole purpose was so that they would pass out before I would. And I drank with men. I didn't really like to drink with women, you know, because I felt like you guys were pretty much sissies. And, you know, probably not the women in this room, but But there was, I was a competitive drinker. I like to hang out with guys. I prefer to hang out with guys. And, it, you know, really, I don't think that. I mean, I don't know. I might have a little bit of women issues. I don't really think I do. I have a lot of women friends, and I get along with women really well. I just have really, I've always felt like I thought more like a man. And so my husband and my brother would probably disagree with you, but I have always, you know, kind of thought that a lot of women's stuff is kind of petty. And so I like that guys are very direct and they say what's on their mind, and, you know, I kind of know where I stand with them. And it never was really because they patted me on the ass, because I was really bummed out that they never did that. So I don't think it was that. when I got to AA, I really thought that I was coming here for a man. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, but I thought, you know, it might be kind of nice to find somebody who doesn't drink and who has a job. Well, 5 years later, I was still in AA, still sober, and my motives had changed. You know, I, after working steps, and, you know, I've had different sponsors in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started to get a little resentment because there for a while every sponsor I got moved away. And, you know, I have a little bit of abandonment issues, but that was kind of ridiculous. And so I had a sponsor at one time who ended up being a traveling nurse, and so she travels all over the universe, and kind of like a vagabond, and I never really know where she's at. And so I thought, you know, I need to have a sponsor here locally that I can, you know, call and talk to, and that can call me on my stuff when she sees me, you know, doing stuff. You know, we have a denial thing, and we do stuff that people don't, we don't realize that we're doing. And I've always believed that you needed to have a woman sponsor if you're a woman, man sponsor if you're a man. That's the way I was taught. And so anyway, I've had different sponsors. When she moved away, I started getting, you know, different people, and then they would move away. And I'm like, okay. And I'm still talking to her. I'm still, you know, emailing her. I'm still talking to her on the phone. I'm still doing all this stuff. And I'm still, it's still her that I'm calling. And, you know, the sponsors I'm getting locally are moving away. And I just said, forget it. You know what I mean? Like, she's my sponsor. She knows me inside and out. She can tell by the tone of my voice what's going on with me. And of all people that's going to call me on my shit, she is definitely one that's going to do it. And so, you know, I've had local sponsors that I've spent less time with. And, you know, she always makes the effort to spend time with me when she's in the area. And, you know, I've spent the night at my house at different times. And, you know, she's my sponsor. So my sponsor is Jackie A., and she just celebrated 35 years of recovery. So I believe that sponsors have sponsors who have sponsors who have sponsors, and that you don't ever outgrow having a sponsor. Because as long as I'm working steps, as long as I'm growing, as long as I'm aging, I have new issues, new awarenesses. And so unless I think I'm going to be cured one day, I think I probably need somebody other than myself to call me on my stuff. And so that's my philosophy on sponsorship. So back to the beginning. I was always one that would talk a lot, say what was on my mind, and as a result of that, I trusted a lot of people that were not really trustworthy. And so what ended up happening was, over a course of time, I came in more trusting than I am today. So that is not the fault of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the fault of the choices that I made. I trust people too quickly. I love big, I'm passionate about everything, and I think everybody wants to do and be and experience all the things that I want and do and be. And I've learned over the years that I have to take my time and get to know people and find out a little bit more about whether or not I want them in my inner circle. You know, I can love and have compassion for my fellow man, but I don't have to invite them in my backyard. And I didn't know how to do that before. You were either in my inner circle or you were on the fucky list. Okay? There was no gray area. There was no working through conflict. There was no, you know, you hurt me and so we need to talk about that, or what did I do to harm you, or there was none of that, you know. We were either in it or we were not in it. And so I want to backtrack just a little bit because before I got sober, I married a man, my first marriage. I've been married twice, still married to my second husband. My first marriage was to a man who was very, very abusive. And I like to talk about this in a meeting, open or closed, because I feel like, especially the women of Alcoholics Anonymous need to hear what I've learned about that. He was very abusive, threw me down stairs, threw me in front of cars, he beat me on a regular basis. And my dad didn't beat my mother. I think my mother beat my dad a few times, but I don't think my dad beat my mother. And I didn't witness those kinds of violent relationships between men and women. But what I've learned about myself is that way, way back when I was 10 years old, I was grabbed by a man from behind and violated. And that changed the course of my life for the rest of my life. So when I married this man when I was 16 years old, I was not pregnant. I didn't have to marry him. But he asked me to marry him, and I thought, honest to God, I better say yes because you only get asked once. That's what I believed. Somehow in my mind, when I heard there's one man for every woman, somehow up here, I turned that into there would only be one man. I was 16 and thought I was a woman and I was a child. So in this step work that I keep talking about, I realized through doing this work with this sponsor that I currently have, that at that age of my life when I married that man, I was in a very formative year of my life. It's when we transition from being young ladies to young women. And I was developing my identity as a woman. And I had very little self-worth as a result of that incident that happened when I was a little girl. And I constantly abused myself by entering into abusive, emotionally abusive relationships with men from that point on. So when I married this man, I truly believed that that was all I could ever do. And I was with him for 2 years. I got pregnant with my son for the sole purpose of proving that I could, because he had me convinced that I was used up goods and could never get pregnant. And so I proved him wrong. And when my son was 2 months old, that man was holding me at gunpoint and threatening to kill me, and my son was from me to mark away. And in a, you know, panic, I grabbed something nearby and smashed it in his face. I don't know where I got the courage to do that. And I ran out the front door, right through the screen door. It was still latched, and ran to the woman across the street. Now, this was one of my God experiences that I didn't realize was God at the time, the woman across the street that opened her door to me was a survivor of domestic violence. When she said to me, "It's never going to get any better. You're going to end up dying if you stay here." And then I called my dad and I said, "I need to come home." And he said, "If you don't get on the plane this time, Jerry, don't call me anymore." Those two events happening at the same time saved my life. But what I did with that is I turned all of that trauma into another excuse for more alcoholism. It was more about, I turned the abuse in on me. That one more time, I'm not worthy. That if I would have been prettier, sweeter, kinder, smarter, he wouldn't have done that to me. So I became a party animal because I could do that perfectly. Okay, so when I got sober and I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I say we come in here wounded, I was wounded. I didn't know how to be with you and not try to get something out of you with some sort of manipulation. Okay? So fast forwarding through my recovery, what I know today is that I am worthy, that I don't deserve to be hit, that I can have a voice, that a woman can be strong and also be a woman, that we don't have to be walked all over just because we wear a skirt sometimes, you know. That I can be loving and kind and passionate, and I can also be smart and strong and independent. And I thought I had to give up one to have the other. And I'm living proof today that you don't. And thank God I found a man that's strong enough in his own sexuality, his own identity as a man, that he's not threatened by my strength or my passion. Thank God. Thank God Alcoholics Anonymous taught him how to be loving and kind and accepting and have compassion and understanding. Thank God. You know, thank God for my sponsor that, you know, came in here a gutter hype and ended up being a nurse of the year. You know? I mean, it, nothing is as it seems. It's what I've figured out here. You know, we come in and this is how we view ourselves, but that's only a perception of what is really, truly the truth. You know, it takes time and work and, you know, sometimes I think I'm falling short of that and I'm not doing enough and, you know, I've been doing a lot of this obsessing over work and crafts and everything else but working on me, you know. But I'll ground out eventually. I usually, like, bottom out is usually what happens. I've lived through having a hysterectomy and didn't drink. I went through my grandfather dying, my grandmother dying, another grandfather dying. My first 2 years of recovery, there were 5 separate deaths in that year. One of them was to suicide. You know, there's not anything that warrants a reason to drink. There's not one drink that would fix that. It would only add to the insanity. You know, when my father died of brain cancer and my family was going through everything that we were going through, watching him being sober and he was the one that was sick and he didn't drink, he didn't use anything, when I thought, God, he's got to be in pain, he would still turn away the the medicine that he could have had, you know. And even with all of that, he didn't drink. He went to his grave a sober alcoholic. How dare I drink? I went through a lot of depression during that time where I felt afraid, very afraid. I was talking to my brother about this the other day. It was a paralyzing fear, like I didn't know how to talk to anybody again, because the pain that was so great felt like as soon as I tried to put a word to it, it didn't describe it. And I knew nobody would understand, so I didn't want to talk about it. That's what I believed. And all of you sons of bitches didn't come and rescue me from my stuff. You know, it's not like y'all are mind readers or nothing, you know. Like, I didn't call anybody. I'd go to the phone, and I'd go to pick it up, and I'd call my sponsor, or I'd call my husband, or I'd, you know. There was one other member of Alcoholics Anonymous that was helping to take care of my dad during that time. And that was my connection. And in all of my dad's insanity, he was still my hero. To watch him go through all of that just made me love him more. I finally came out of that depression. Obviously, I'm still here. I've stayed sober. In the last few years, things have been really rough. I came really close to losing our house. Our business was not doing well. We had been under a lot of stress. I started working a second job. I'm going on 4 years working two jobs. Most weeks I have one day off a week. I'm probably in a place now where I could take, after the holidays, I could probably take one more day off. But there's still a lot of fear as a result of going through that. Like, if I let go of one, the other one's going to crash. And I know that it's just a matter of me doing more work on myself. And, you know, I'll get to the promises where, you know, intuitively know how to handle things that used to baffle us. And, you know, for me, it's finance. And money is my higher power sometimes, you know. I have to say that. When I don't have it, I don't feel near as much at peace. I've been poor. I barely made $50 a week and was grateful for that when I first got sober. So it's not like I came here with, you know, tons of change in my pocket. Sometimes I didn't have money to put in the basket, you know. But things are different today, and I've gotten, you know, accustomed to living the way I live, and I don't want to change that. I'm a glutton. I want more. And, you know, I can admit that. It's a character defect, I guess. If I get rich, it won't be a character defect, right? I mean, if I'm constantly chasing the money like, you know, a bottle or a bag, then, you know, and I never get it, then people will say it's a character defect. But if I chase it and I get it, then I'm a successful woman. So, you know, matter of perception. This last year also, my mom has not been doing very well health-wise, and on my recovery birthday, October 7th, my mom fell outside of a hotel in Sacramento area the night before my niece's wedding, and she ended up in the ER almost all night, and broke her arm, pretty severe arm, broken arm, and recently had surgery and had to go to rehab hospital, and has battled congestive heart failure and emphysema and all these things, you know. And I was talking to her on the way up to the wedding, because she's gotten, you know, she's an alcoholic, sober, that does, you know, she's read the book, that she doesn't work steps or go to meetings, that she's stayed sober, stark raving sober. And I love her dearly. She's a kick in the pants, has a great sense of humor. But as much as she can be, you know, full of joy and happiness, she can also be just as full of insanity. And as you know, alcoholism untreated, it ends up being a sack full of fear. And as she gets older, what I've witnessed is that she's more and more full of fear. And so we were talking on the way up there, and I said, you know, Mom, you know, meditation, the steps, meetings, sponsorship, that, you know, it might help you. You know, I'm 79 years old. What the hell am I going to learn at 79? Like, oh, you know, I don't know, one thing more that you knew at 78. I don't know, you know, but I'm thinking something might help, you know. And so she said, you know, I think I might go to some of those meetings with you. Maybe it will help me. Because I've watched people in Alcoholics Anonymous when they're coming to their time of passing, and they seem to do it with much more peace than those that don't have it. I mean, I don't know if you've ever witnessed that, but I witnessed that with my dad. It was like, he didn't really do Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, but unlike my mom, he tended to take what he read in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and apply it in his life. I think it might have been because he's a teacher, and so, you know, you learn it, you know, use it kind of thing. But it's been more difficult for my mom to do that. And so I asked her the other day, I said, do you remember saying that you know, might want to go to a meeting? And she said, yeah, but you know, I'm just so weak right now. And I said, you know, you can go when you want, but when you're ready, I'll take you. So my home group is the Tuesday night women's meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. All you women are welcome. It is a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not prejudiced. We just think that we want to have a clear message of Alcoholics Anonymous to women who come there. So please come. We love having new blood. So anyway, that will be the meeting that I take her to when she's ready to go. And she'll be a kick in the pants for the Tuesday night girl. So how do I want to wrap this up? So I didn't really celebrate my birthday. It didn't feel like a celebration, and I've been busy with hospital visits between my mother and my husband's mother. The day she got out of the hospital, my husband's mom went in. And so the last couple of months have been welcome to aging. You know, this is where we get to take care of our parents because they took care of us. And at least that's my belief. My mom and dad did take care of me. And so, you know, they may have made a lot of mistakes, but I've always known that they both love me. And, you know, I am sure that I made a shitload of mistakes, too. I have one son who is my biological son, and I have four stepchildren, all of them adults. The oldest child is 39. And the youngest one, I think, is a couple years younger than my son, so she's probably 32. And between us, we have six grandchildren. Thank you for the, what do you call that? Teleprompter. Rick's my teleprompter. One biological granddaughter who lives here in Visalia, who is the light of my life. And I've recently had the joy and pleasure of my brother coming home. I'm going to cry about that. I've been praying for him for a long time. He's the guy that took me to my first meeting, basically, met me at my first meeting, and showed me what this thing about recovery was all about. And with double digits recovery, he went back out, and I've never really known, like, you know, how bad it is, or, you know, kind of been afraid to ask. I've had sneaky suspicions, but, you know, what I thought it was bad enough, and then I come to find out it was worse than that. So I'm really glad that he's here and sober. He came out here and has been living with us for about 4 months, and it's been a joy and a pleasure to get close to him again. Alcoholics Anonymous, it saved my family. And I'm sure our kids, at some point, if they need it, will end up here too. You know? We were terrible examples while we were doing what we were doing, and hopefully we're much better examples today. So I want to say thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous for saving my life and saving my family's life. You know, this place, you think you're going to just come here and sit here and listen to a bunch of drunks whine, and magical things happen. And, you know, I would just urge you to once in a while get to a meeting early enough to sit in the front, or sit with new people, or shake hands with people you've never met before, you know. The person that sits by themselves a lot, you know, it doesn't mean they want to be alone. They think they do, but they really don't. It's absolutely true, you know. Sometimes what looks like I want to be alone is really I'm scared to death of you, you know, and it just takes one person to smile and say welcome, to melt the heart, you know. So I want to say thank you for inviting me here, and I hope that something I said helped one other alcoholic stay sober today. I think this is a wonderful meeting, and thank you for having me.